thanks for coming along tonight. We're Dr. Ida Lichtenberg, a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. She's known to many of you, but I will introduce her on the occasion of the publication of her book, The Secret Magic of Music, Conversations with Musical Masters. Ida Lichtenberg is a psychiatrist based in Sydney. She's been involved with music for most of her life and studied piano performance and theory before taking up a career in medicine and specialising in psychiatry. For many years, she lived in London with her family and was intimately involved with Wigmore Hall, one of the leading venues for performance of chamber music, and she is also a founder and director of music in the Hunter Festival, a chamber music festival in New South Wales. In New South Wales. Australia. Inaugurated. I missed a line. Inaugurated in 1991 to commemorate the bicentenary of Mozart's death. So I got that. So tonight, Ida Lichtenberg is going to address the Sydney Institute on why music matters. Dr. Lichtenberg, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you to the Sydney Institute, which I think you'll all agree gives a platform to a very wide variety of topics that are vital to our country and our civilization. And thanks to Anne and Gerard for tonight's opportunity for a break from elections, Brexit and bombs. Ludwig van Beethoven said, "Music is higher revelation than all wisdom and philosophy, the mediator between the spiritual and the sensual life." Or is music simply auditory cheesecake, enjoyed by the elite, as the commentator Steven Pinker said? Clearly, they were both talking about Western classical music, also known as serious or art music. But what did they mean? Why is Western music held in such a high regard by some? Do we really need it? What's its social function? These questions were important to me as music has been a lifelong passion, and as an amateur musician and an administrator of chamber music festival, I've been involved in music for most of my life. I decided to approach these questions through conversations with professional performing musicians, some Australian, but mostly international artists touring Australia as members of chamber music groups. And we discussed many other questions as well, including, is music transformative? A form of therapy? Healing? A spiritual experience? Or is it a political weapon? How does it work? And why do so many people find contemporary classical music unpalatable? And I was also concerned with the future, because if public money, increasingly in short supply, is to be spent on music, we need to know about its benefits. So what I'm going to talk about are my reflections on these conversations, and I focused on classical, but in particular chamber music, which is a genre for the most intimate thoughts and feelings of some of the greatest composers. History shows that music is an important part of most cultures as a non-verbal language of emotions, and as classical or art music of the West developed over time, it became central to Western culture, and to some extent even an auditory recollection of our social history. The immense progress of this music in the West depended on a particular development about 1,000 years ago, when an Italian monk, Guido of Arezzo, invented modern musical notation. What did that mean? It was revolutionary, because now music could be written down and it could acquire the complexity that it did. So what is actually going on in music? It's really about an intersecting threesome: the composer, the performer, and the listener. So I want to invite you to join me in the view from each. In the process, I hope we'll find some answers to the questions. First, let's sit in the composer's chair. Composers have tried to channel what it feels to be human into musical sounds. This requires a multifaceted intellectual effort involving theory, structure, aesthetics, and maths. But they also became adept at producing emotional transmission through tempo and rhythm, and particularly through harmony and the tensions in chords. The tension in the dissonant chords, followed by resolution, produces a feeling of relief, and it's a magical effect that tugs people emotionally. If you stop on a certain chord in a piece by Bach, it could sound dissonant, but at the same time, the discord lends considerable character and richness. Through this brokenness in his music, Bach was actually reflecting on the death of Jesus, broken on a cross, and a symbol of the broken world in Christianity. And meaning can also be derived from musical structures such as sonata form or the fugue, which takes a theme and keys on a journey. Their return to home generates a sense of inevitability and order. And this process holds equally true for a pop song or a Mahler symphony. The listener's journey can present a metaphor for life's passage, starting with the despair, perhaps, in a theme, followed by its transmutation through many developments, until finally, when the theme returns, the listener is just that little bit older and armed with more knowledge. The philosophies and the musical expression of many composers revolve around the nobility of human love and relationships, wonderment and reverence for the natural world, and humour as well. But the great pieces are not easily categorised and contain secrets only divulged upon close scrutiny of many years. If there is a message conveyed by the composer, it's usually conjectural, subtle, and personal. It might portray a love letter. For example, the second movement of Brahms' Piano Concerto No. 1 in D minor is perhaps a love letter to Clara Wieck, the wife of composer Robert Schumann. Or the music might contain a political message. When Stalin expected Shostakovich to convey strong sentiments of nationalism and victory in his Symphony No. 9, Shostakovich defiantly scored it for a smaller orchestra with mocking humour and less melody and passion compared with his previous symphonies. Both Shostakovich and Prokofiev stood up to Stalin when they expressed political dissent in their compositions, as well as the beauty and pain of life in times of war and revolution. It seems that certain totalitarian regimes want to control music. During the Cultural Revolution in China, pro-communist songs and marches were allowed, but Western classical music was, in fact, severely restricted. The comic operas of Gilbert and Sullivan often contain an overt political message, and subtle subversion of the social order has been ascribed to Mozart. Occasionally, music aligns with political idealism. Verdi's song Va Pensiero, the chorus of the Hebrew slaves from his opera Nabucco, became an Italian anthem for patriotic unification and freedom from foreign rule. Politics can also be associated with pop music, such as the songs of Bob Dylan that aroused young people who protested against the Vietnam War. Composers have been able to give expression to the human struggle in accordance to their own personalities. For example, Mozart tends to speak to the individual, whereas Beethoven talks to all mankind. In his operas, Mozart portrayed complex human characteristics, and some of the dialogues and counterpoint in his late string quartets are very reminiscent of opera ensembles with several voices and themes of jealousy, bitterness, romance, and love, exposing some of the naked truths about human behaviour and motivation. Beethoven's music approaches our purpose on earth through its reflection of nature and intense awareness of values important to humanity. Beauty, diversity, structure and complexity. The tension and relaxation in the music reflect the natural world in the flowers that open in the morning and close at night, in the tightening and expansion of muscles, and the contrast of a storm followed by calm. Beethoven also expresses contrast in the opposition of ugliness and beauty as the true mirror of life. The fugue section in his Hammerklavier Sonata is ugly, but the slow second movement is a testament to loveliness and serenity. His music can attract some people almost like a drug, as they feel a deep spiritual, even transformational connection. Like eating a piece of chocolate or being in love, his music can lead to states of mind when the whole world seems a better place. And his house in Bonn is one of the city's most popular tourist destinations, and there are usually fresh flowers on his grave in Vienna. In contrast, Bach had mainly celestial concerns. He marked his music Soli Dei Gloria, to God alone be the glory, and found his role models in the temple musicians described in the Chronicles of the Bible. In Bach's view, the offerings of temple musicians had glorified God, who then favoured them with his presence during their performance. Of course, all music, whether indigenous, African or European, is valid and full of emotion, but in the Western tradition, composers such as Bach, Mozart and Beethoven have a very special place. So what happened to contemporary classical music? In the early 20th century, harmonies became very complicated and dissonant, with some notes in the chord only a semitone apart. And this musical language was unfamiliar, bewildering and ugly for many people. However, now there is a real desire by composers to reconnect with their audience rather than impress their colleagues. Certain ideologues have had an important impact on Western music. Since the mid-20th century, the ideas of music philosopher Theodore Adorno became influential. He delegitimized popular enjoyment of classical music and claimed that only the radical atonal variety was able to convey truth and hope and act as a trigger for social protest and political change. These concepts acted to alienate composers of new music from society and fostered an elitism that assigned superior intellectual and social value to their works. More recently, in his book, What Good Are the Arts?, former Oxford English professor John Carey attacked elitist views and made a case for relativism, reinforcing the notion that artistic judgment was relative and dependent upon individual taste. Let's now sit in the performer's chair. We've been in the composers, we'll go to the performers. Most performing artists feel that a live audience is required for maximum inspiration and communication. A creative interface exists between the performer and the audience, involving a reciprocal transfer of emotions. Impromptu inventiveness can occur, encouraged by rapport between the two and the electricity in a concert hall. Very occasionally, an exceptional moment can occur. Composer and lyricist Stephen Sondheim spoke of these hyper moments, and referring to musicals, he remarked on the need for lots of laughs and a few moments to cry, along with one special moment when members of the audience are aware of a certain joy or the feeling that they understand why they are there. What might be happening? When artists perform, they are stimulated by the power of imagination. For a singer, the mind paints the picture and the vocal mechanism responds to give the voice colour. When the sound undergoes these changes, that's when the audience reacts. The four instruments of the string quartet portray multiple voices and feelings, reminiscent of four characters in an opera, when one might be singing about a lost love, two are providing a commentary, and the other is doing the sweeping at the back of the stage. A high standard of quartet playing requires real virtuosity and intense involvement with complex, profound music and mastering the dazzling cycle of Beethoven's 16-string quartets, representing a holy grail and a lifetime's work. I must tell you that following the last concert of such a cycle, a lady came backstage to see the first violinist of a famous string quartet. He thought that she was going to tell him how she felt about the works and some emotional impact. But instead she said to him, "Do you know, I missed the black patent leather shoes that you wore at the last concert." So let's now sit in the audience or the listener's chair. Most of us are aware that we are not entirely satisfied by the material world and this world of high-speed activity. Music has the potential to lift us out of that world, enabling us to experience even a sort of ecstasy or transcendence for a short while. And even when the music is disturbing and bleak, the great works retain a sanguine core. For the audience, music works simultaneously on the intellectual and the visceral level, and the visceral level is immediate. However, a little exposure is usually required. The Russian musicologist Mikhail Kazinik has a relevant story. The great pianist Sviatoslav Richter claimed that good music and performance would always reach any listener. Kazinik tested Richter's hypothesis by taking a group of ordinary schoolboys to a concert of Beethoven sonatas. They thought the music was horrid and very boring. At a later time, he began teaching them a course on music, and when they got to the Beethoven sonatas, he played a recording of one they'd heard at that concert. They said it was beautiful, but they were adamant it was not the same music they'd heard at that concert. So for those who want to delve intellectually, there's abundant challenge, such as the polyphony in Bach, but even a seasoned audience doesn't intellectualise a great deal and simply receives pleasure from the music. More than the other arts, music has the capacity to conform with one's mood or change it. Many people who want to feel happy turn the radio on to easy listening and sing along or dance. Re-experiencing a broad range of emotions and emotional intensity in a safe, controlled environment does seem beneficial for listeners in a process that could be considered a form of therapy. Emotions in the music cover the full range from exhilaration to despair, like love, jealousy, anger, sadness, and as suggested by research data, even melancholic music can be beneficial. But journeys with the great compositions are much more than entertainment, relaxation, and simple comfort. And as with all art, we encounter confrontation, sorrow, and loss. Music can also induce a sense of mastery, and Beethoven in particular can make the listener feel empowered. There's a majestic, heroic strength in his music, which is particularly evident in the slow movements of the symphonies. And if a performance is convincing, it should trigger many personal associations, especially if people are able to reminisce about it. People are also uplifted and transported to a high level of awareness, a meditative state, or existential contemplation, although such an experience really requires active surrender to the musical journey. And there are, of course, special times when performers manage to give the audience a glimpse of magnificent, even ethereal, beauty, when the interaction between the two, the performer and the audience, is very powerful. However, I should say, the emotional impacts are idiosyncratic and often depend on the listener's state of mind. Some music is well known for its cathartic power and emotional release, and an oft-mentioned example is Beethoven's String Quartet Opus 132, written after the composer had recovered from a serious illness. He marked the third movement with the inscription, and I'll translate, "a convalescent's holy song of thanksgiving to the divinity" in the Lydian mode. In it, he expresses gratitude and perceptions of awe and beauty, and many performers and listeners report that when they hear or play this work, they experience feelings associated with past losses as well as relief and consolation. Now, Schubert's music can take the listener through blind rage, melancholy and tranquility within minutes. Some of his intense work is black and speaks of despair, horror and death, but not with the intention of adding darkness to people's lives, simply articulating ideas and emotions difficult to express in words. His great A major sonata, Deutsch 959, passes through a landscape of deep feelings, and in the last movement, Schubert takes his time, as he always does, meandering, to allow reflection. Finally, the end of the work approaches, but he seems unable to let go. The theme has recurred throughout this movement, and the listener has come to know it as a close friend, but at the end, it's repeated with a slightly different harmony, a semitone difference in an F natural instead of an F sharp. And this tiny change is unsettling. It's as if someone is trying to say goodbye to a friend, but unable to part, wanting just a little more time. And after all the emotional turmoil of the journey, we come to this point of departure without resolution. And in typical Schubert fashion, we're left to resolve the separation later in our own time. And Beethoven, of course, employs similar elements, but unlike Schubert, he gives more answers. Now, studies have shown that while people listen to music, pleasurable feelings are linked to a variety of physical responses, like shivers and altered heart rate and breathing. There's evidence that these experiences are associated with the activation of blood flow to regions of the brain that release the chemical dopamine, a neurotransmitter involved in euphoria, motivation, and addiction. The three overlapping circles of the Venn diagram help explain how the emotional transmission is affected. One circle represents the composer's creation and intention, the second one, the artist's interpretation, and the third, the participation of the audience. And when the three combine to form the overlapping sweet spot in the middle, the intense emotional transmission can be realised, but not guaranteed. Memory for music is surprisingly well preserved and used therapeutically to stimulate mental capacity and communication in degenerative neurological conditions. The pianist Angela Hewitt related what happened one Sunday in Easter when she played a hymn for the patients on an Alzheimer's ward. To the great surprise of staff and visitors, a man who'd not spoken a word to anyone for 2 years suddenly began singing all the words of the hymn, bringing everyone to tears. It seems that people with dementia may still relate to music, its retention being held in a different part of the brain than other forms of memory. If consolation is considered part of therapy, then music is an important source, not only in relation to personal traumas, but also in subjugated societies, such as the former Soviet Union. In the midst of oppression, people found escape in music, and the conservatory was an island of sanity for many musicians. Before the Berlin Wall came down, music also provided consolation and played a part in the East German protests. People were fearful of expressing dissent because the Stasi secret police spied on the population at large. It was the time of the Tiananmen Square protests and the Chinese government's harsh response to calls for freedom. Many East Germans feared their government might turn on its own population in the same way. However, during 1989, small groups of East Germans were beginning to protest after church services, such as those at St. Thomas's, where a regular Friday evening service was held with music, including Bach. The music didn't promote revolutionary fervour, but it did give people respite and strength. And you know what's interesting? The same sort of music had been used for political propaganda in the early stages of the German Democratic Republic. When the communist government extolled Bach's music as a source of elevation and identity for the ascendant working class. This group bonding through music that happened in East Germany is an important part of audience experience in general, and the continuation of religious worship going back to ancient temple services in Jerusalem and later in the Christian church. And today, the connections between performers and audience, members of the audience with each other, and amateurs who sing in choirs continue this long tradition. An example of the power of music to assist in group bonding was related by the Norwegian violinist Ollie Bohn. He plays an exquisite 1766 Guadagnini violin, acquired for his use by a Norwegian bank. And after giving some thought to the way music could assist the bank in its work, he came up with the concept of short concerts associated with business meetings. During a break in discussions, he would arrive with his accompanist, talk briefly about the violin, and then play for 10 or 15 minutes. And these mini-concerts invariably broke the ice and initiated a change in the atmosphere and conversation, and somehow helped to clarify problems and their solutions. Perhaps the psychological mechanism in group bonding involves shared emotions of pleasure, connection, purpose, trust, and a sense of belonging. And after a concert, there's also a social dimension, as relationships among members of an audience can alter and deepen, and people feel united in discussion and action. The physiological mechanism probably involves stimulation of the hormone oxytocin, which is the glue that binds lovers and builds feelings of trust, happiness, and benevolence. But can music change behaviour? Perhaps not directly, but it can be enabling. Being an avid listener of classical music won't make someone a better person. A Mozart enthusiast can be a scoundrel, but perhaps people who immerse themselves in classical music tend to be more thoughtful, reflective, and more responsive and attentive to others. Well, apart from therapy while we were in the listener's chair, what are some of the other benefits of Western art music? There is some evidence for its healing effect. Studies have shown that daily sessions of music-guided slow breathing or live piano music can reduce blood pressure. Singing or instrumental music may assist in calming newborn babies and manage their pain during procedures. When a group of healthy premature babies were exposed to half an hour of Mozart on two consecutive days, their energy expenditure decreased compared with another group that didn't hear the same music. Music therapy is an established part of management in drug and alcohol rehabilitation and mental illness and children's sports. The transformative potential of music was a vital interest of violinist Yehudi Menuhin, who established Live Music Now to utilise the therapeutic potential of music for people in need. Some performing musicians who gave concerts to the organisation in prisons received appreciative letters from murderers and rapists who felt calmed by Mozart and Beethoven. An important aspect of music is its universality, because there's no barrier due to spoken language or national borders, and anyone can respond to the feelings. It provides a sense of unity in times of war or stress, and often brings people together when they sing their national anthem or mark significant social events. All cultures seem to respond to music. Following the Second World War, Western music emerged as a significant cross-cultural communication and a source of high value to the Japanese people. And the Tokyo String Quartet became one of the world's leading ensembles. Kazuhiro Isamura, the violist, started to play a musical instrument after 1946 when his mother vowed that her sons should have nothing to do with war and music seemed a healthier alternative. Chamber music has a special cross-cultural place as a paradigm for cooperation, intense listening, negotiation, and empathy. And as such, I think it's also a model for humanity. And here I should mention Musica Viva Australia, started by violist Richard Goldner. He and other refugees from Nazi Germany found solace in chamber music during hard times in pre-war and wartime Europe and wanted to share this music as a gift to their new country. When he escaped Vienna and arrived in Australia in 1939, Goldner auditioned for the Sydney Symphony, but as a foreign national he was denied the post and instead worked as a jeweller. Known for his inventive skills, he was approached by the War Office to design a zipper for parachutes. The design brought in some money, which he used to establish the Musica Viva Society in collaboration with Charles Berg and other refugees. Music has also appeared as an agent of social change. The El Sistema National Music Program in Venezuela has trained about 400,000 disadvantaged children and created a network of orchestras that diverted adolescents from truancy and crime, and in the process these children were able to form one of the best youth orchestras in the world. And this program has been copied all over the world. Classical music also brought purpose and achievement to Paraguayan slum children who built and played orchestral instruments made out of recycled landfill rubbish. In other examples of social change, music has been shown to reduce crime. In 2004, the British Transport Police piped classical music into the London Underground stations in some of the most dangerous neighbourhoods. And after playing the music for 6 months, robberies were cut by 33%, staff assaults decreased by 25%, and vandalism went down 37%. But I'm not sure whether delinquents were deterred because they were driven away by the music or they were actually pacified. As far as children are concerned, learning music is beneficial because they develop brain function, dexterity, and self-discipline. And lots of social skills. And the idea that studying music improves the intellect is not new, but there is now good evidence from a study conducted in the University of Toronto where 6-year-old kids who were given music lessons for a year showed increases in IQ compared with those who didn't. Does music have a moral value? The Nazis' love of music is a forceful argument against it. And wielders of evil, like the Nazis, misused it. But such exploitation does not diminish its beauty and positive function. And as one of my interviewees said, a bread knife can cut or kill, but that does not vilify the knife. It depends how you use it. Is classical music elitist? Well, people are very mistaken if they believe it is, as subscribers come from all socioeconomic groups, and today anybody can study and listen to it. Almost everyone is involved in everyday life with music, and a lot of people don't realise that classical music is used as the soundtrack for movies. Or that music arouses the sort of fantasy and creativity and self-expression which is important for everyday relationships and work. And I have no doubt that any music, whether classical, jazz or pop, can stimulate the brain in similar ways. When I embarked on this project several years ago, I was seeking answers to questions about music's association with individual and social issues and its contribution to civilization. In the past, such a quest would have taken for granted that it was a secure aesthetic, which only required reinforcing the current audience base and revealing music to new listeners who might come to love and value the art. But today, classical music is under some threat. The number of live performances has dwindled as people get their music from the internet at any time of the day, and their iPods with vast amounts of music can provide entertainment to suit any mood. The ideology of relativism, although well-intentioned, has contributed to a shift in values and led to the view that all disciplines and ideas can be considered equally valid. This ideology puts art music on a par with other genres, and therefore the great classical compositions and recreative performing musicians have no claim to preeminence. Western cultural traditions are being dumbed down, which is a shame because the traditions in art music have taken hundreds of years to build. And now there is another threat to music in general, which has arisen from political Islam. Maybe musicians might soon join cartoonists on the front line of attacks. A ban on music is a core tenet of violent Islamist groups. When Islamic State took control of Raqqa in northeast Syria, they first imposed full face veiling on women and then banned music. For the supposed crime of listening to pop music, Islamic State beheaded a 15-year-old boy in Mosul. In 2012, the jihadists who took over northern Mali beat people for listening to music and destroyed instruments and cassettes. If Islamic extremists were free to extend their influence and control in the West, they would surely attempt the demise of Western music, already evident in London borough poster campaigns with signs that were captioned, "No music or concerts." Could we put the jihadists' fear and hatred of classical music to good use? Perhaps, Perhaps music would be better than bullets to repel them. Some British forces had blasted Bollywood tunes at Islamic State fighters to unnerve them. So what does the future hold? It's not beyond the realm of possibility that the study and performance of art music could be seriously crushed in two or three generations if it's not protected and given special status. This requires some funding, but above all, the will to promote music education and live performance. The successful El Sistema program now overlaps with music curricula, such as Music Aviva's Live Performance Plus, designed for schools. As in sports, this program demands self-discipline, constant repetition, resilience, and working for long-term goals, which are lessons often lost in current education. In terms of music performance, there could be more interest in multimedia in the future and combinations of different mediums, such as the string quartet, together with radio and video installations. And although some people fear that interest in classical music is flagging in the West, its fervent embrace in Asia can be seen as a triumph for Western music. In China, people are finding great value in the art as part of a good education for children, an investment in their future and development of correct behaviour and self-discipline. Over 40 million children in China are learning to play the piano. And when Western musicians perform in China, the large audiences are hugely enthusiastic and full of children. There are still many unknowns about music, and in regard to the mechanism of transcendence, perhaps theoretical physics will be able to enlighten us in the future. Michio Kaku, the physicist who co-founded string theory, has said the universe could be a symphony of vibrating strings, and the mind of God that Einstein wrote about might turn out to be cosmic music. In the meantime, we are limited to earthbound music and its protection. In this age of increasing fear and violence, we need more music, and I believe the world would be a much poorer place without it. For us in the audience, music opens a gentle door to pleasure, if not transformation, through the magical space between performer and listener. Here, we can experience music as the language of emotions, love, excitement, consolation, joy, reverence, humour, and we can also develop our capabilities of sincerity, empathy, cooperation, reflection, creativity, purpose and transcendence. Is there much more to ask for? As Shakespeare said, if music be the food of love, play on. Thank you.
Many thanks to Ina Lichter. Now, as I said earlier, we have copies of The Secret Magic of Music and Conversations with Music Masters, which Anne has down there, and I'm sure the author would be happy to sign them after the event. And so we come to questions and discussion, and we finish no later than the top of the hour. And since there are a lot of people here, can I ask you to keep your comments or your questions short? Just as someone who has no understanding much in this area, to what extent is music language? I mean, to what extent do you need to be able to read music to understand music, or is that not necessary?
It's not necessary at all. It's just a matter of being open to it and allowing it to become a part of your experience. And for most people in the audience, they don't understand the theoretical side of music at all. They just respond emotionally to it. I mean, if you want to enhance the experience, then talking about it and more information is important. And we find, for example, in our music festival, Music in the Hunter, that our pre-concert speaker, Ken Healy, who's a wonderful communicator, is able to get people to think about the music, think about what is important to listen for. So they go straight from the talk to the music and they get the pleasure of finding out for themselves, because everybody likes structure. Everybody wants to understand what's going on and to become part of the experience. So we don't need to know the detail.
Before going to the next question, I should say thanks to King & Wood Mellison for the use of this great facility this evening. Rachel?
Your talk is as rich as your book is, I know, because I read the manuscript, so I strongly recommend it. I want to ask you a question as a psychiatrist. I just recently spoke to Elena Katz-Ternan, whose middle son suffers mental illness. And she used to write very jagged, very experimental, very contemporary music until she realized that that was not the sort of music he wanted to hear. And hence, she changed the style of her music. And now we all know how beautiful and engaging and dance-like and embracing her music is. I wanted to ask you, is there any evidence that a child, a baby, a little girl, a little boy, raised in loud noises, jagged music, lots of what I would say, that could be rock, it could be hip-hop, it could be electronic, it could be all sorts of things going on, very noisy stuff. Is there any evidence that creates some emotional or mental dysfunction?
It's a great question, and you would think so, but the evidence hasn't supported that. They've looked at aggressive music, with belligerent rap, and the jury's still out on it, but the general idea is that perhaps it allows some emotional release. But where it makes a big difference is when you combine the music with the visuals. If it's a video, then people think that it does have a more serious effect.
Question down the back.
Nice to see you there.
Hello, how are you?
Could you talk a little bit more about the capacity of opera or music to take you into your own world of reverie and introspection and almost lose contact with the performance?
Well, this is the magic of it. By getting into what I call this alchemic space between the performer and the and the audience. Now, the audience needs to let go and to realize that it's all for them and that all they need is to give up the control. They can't always do it because they come tired and worried and they're not in a mood. But once they learn it, once it becomes possible, what they really need is a bit of exposure to it. Now, they say that if you listen to a lot of music, for example, if a whole opera, if you're listening carefully, you need to get into the language. By the time you're halfway through the opera, you're into that language, if you're given into it, and you're much more responsive. And it's the same with a lot of music. For example, some cellists play all the Bach cello suites in one day, quite a feat, of course. And so they say that after halfway through, a lot of the people who don't even know much about the music are into the language and they can become a part of it. The most important thing is to let yourself go wherever you want and almost follow your emotions, because it's a language of emotions. Basically, once you start following your emotions, then you can understand it. Now, a lot of it is about loss. A lot of the music is about anguish and about things which are very close to all of us. And so if the performance is very convincing, and that's very important. And if there's not too much going on and people can respond to it, if it's a good production, for example, and if the singers can go outside themselves, as I described, if they can imagine what they want. Because the performers are thinking, what do I want the audience to hear? And what they want them to hear is what's going on in their brain. And if they can do that, it doesn't always happen, then you get that possibility. But I think for the ordinary person, like all of us in the audience, it's just a matter of concentration, really, and allowing it to happen.
Michael Byrne?
I think I can bellow.
Okay.
Focusing on your comment about the brain and the response, I imagine a chemical response.
Yeah.
Has there been any measurements of the different chemical responses, say, to a melodic line, a harmony, rhythm, as against dissonance? And the reason I ask that, because I imagine there'd be different responses, the reason I ask that is that the dairy farmers in my old electorate claimed that with a nice melodic line in music played to the cows, a nice harmony, a nice rhythm, they got excellent milk yields, but if they played dissonance or rock and roll, they got bad yields. Now, in other words, I'm interested in, is this your comments about chemical reaction, has there been established any difference between those styles of music?
I think it's a great experiment, and I think you're perhaps the only person who's going to support that work. But I think it's a very important issue because the whole idea of dissonance and atonal music, the jury is still out. I mean, we've had it for 100 years, and some people are saying, well, it's still not completely acceptable. By this time, it should be, because, of course, Beethoven and Liszt went through it. They didn't get good crits for some, and they didn't get through. The Grosse Fugue by Beethoven is still a problem for people. So maybe we are wired for harmonic music. Certainly the cows are. So. But having said that, I think we have to give the composers an opportunity and maybe show the cows some contemporary music which is melodic, like some of the new composers are wanting to connect with audiences again. You know, they went through this stage where they only wanted to talk to each other and show how clever they were, and they're intellectualizing all the time. Well, cows aren't intellectual. They're visceral creatures. They want emotion. So I think this is a very important contribution if it can be
made. I'm still a cow.
Want to do anything to push up milk prices? There's a question up here.
Yes, Chris Russell. So I can just add to that as a dairy nutritionist. That oxytocin, which you mentioned earlier, is actually letdown hormone for milk in
cows. It is indeed.
My question relates to your comments about language. And I mean, I think music, if it's a language, it's a language of many dialects. The dialect of Peter Sculthorpe to the dialect of Rachmaninoff or indeed to Bach. I'm wondering whether, in fact, those different dialects are as important in the reactions you're talking about as the sort of general genre that you've been talking about of classical music, in as much as you could play, you know, Peter Sculthorpe to a child all day, and that may have put them off the idea of classical music, and whereas you happily, unhappily, we haven't had another Rachmaninoff since Rachmaninoff, but you could play Rachmaninoff to him and have the opposite effect. And I'm wondering whether we're generalising here.
Well, it's interesting when you talk about this issue. You do have to look at children, and I'm glad you've mentioned children, because a lot of musicians who play atonal music say that when they go to kindergartens and when they play this music to children, they don't react negatively. It's only when they get older and when they hear other opinions or other music that they start changing, so perhaps we are wired differently. But you're right, there is a different language. I think the divide comes between the harmonic classical and the atonal. Perhaps that's the real divide. And that's where we need to look at the different visceral components to it. A lot of people just don't respond to it. In fact, they're put off. I'm not going to go into what this might mean for society and the philosophical meaning of it. I mean, there are some musicians I've spoken to who feel that it's really part of the cynical world that we belong in. I mean, I talked, for example, about dissonance, that in the harmonic style, in our traditional style, dissonance has to be resolved. And if you say, look at the Les Adieux sonata of Beethoven, which is a descriptive one, where his patron and friend, Prince Rudolf, goes away. So the first movement is the pain of loss, the second movement is a sort of reflection, and he leaves chords of ninths unresolved. And it's only when they're resolved in the third movement, the peals of bells and happiness, that it all makes sense. And so that's what we are used to. When in a lot of contemporary music there's no resolution, what does this mean? So that's a whole other issue, and it's something that perhaps we can discuss at another time.
At the back.
The discussion around diminishing audiences and interest in live music performance has generated a lot of discussion and theorising, and one view that's expressed is that we should reconsider audience customs and practices, some which are seen as being elite, so, and not worry if people clap between movements and so on. When you referred earlier to the different perspective of the composer and the performer and the audience, I sort of think those sort of views about doing away with those customs doesn't give enough account to the role of the composer and the performer in that. Or am I being too elitist? And should we be open to change in the way we listen to music, and if it's going to supposedly break down barriers to appreciation?
Yes, I think you're right, and that's probably why a lot of art presenters are pulling in world music now. They are pulling in multimedia. They're also saying, well, what is it that counts in a concert hall? Do we need a big concert hall? No. We probably need smaller concert halls. That's what people are wanting. So they're re-evaluating all this. But the key issue here is live music. Do we need live music? Or are people happy with listening to recording? Now, there wasn't a single musician I spoke to who didn't want to make this point that live music is so different. When they record, they can do other things which are very important. I mean, the microphone can, you know, let them magnify the dynamics and many other issues in a way that a live it wouldn't project on the stage. But the important aspect of live music is the spontaneity, the idea that you can have special moments and that you have this relationship with the performer and with the people around you. That is very vital. So that all has to be factored in. And when people are listening to their iPads and their phones and all that, they're not connecting in the same way at all. So, yes, we need input from people like yourself on what matters.
Jeff?
I'm an agnostic, Jeff Hogman. I'm an agnostic, but I grew up in at a time when there was church music in schools, and community concerts, and so on. And a lot of my appreciation of music, I think, started from that time. I understand now that some schools don't even have music programs. Should we be doing more to... particularly as the voice is costless, to harness voice and choral music as a way of fostering music appreciation?
Well, I would certainly agree with you 100%, and that's something that can be done easily, and it's a participatory, which is extremely important as well. And if you want to have a new audience, a new generation to appreciate music, that is the only way to do it, by getting them interested. And as far as religion goes, I mean, you talked about the church. A lot of people, even secular people, are turning to music, not exactly as a religion, but as something transformative, something transcendent. I mean, it goes through all the items that I've mentioned, but of course it doesn't tell you about things like justice and charity and altruism, but that's another matter. But it can tell you about decency, if you want to let it. I mean, there are so many people, when I spoke to choir masters, for example, who only work with mostly with church music, that so many of the academics that come to the performances love the music, even though they hate the idea of religion. They hate it, but they still follow it.
Final question.
Yes, I was just wondering, you mentioned that the values of art music may be changing now because of iPads or iPods and, you know, less people listening to live music. But isn't it the other way around when you consider that the history of art music or the nature of art music being elitist by definition, and you consider that someone like Bach, his music wasn't revived until the Romantic period, classical music from Beethoven and stuff was paid by nobles, and that Romantic music was played in small salons, that many people didn't even listen to this type of music to begin with, and that we actually have this proliferation today thanks to modern technology and spreading of this
type of music.
Well, that's the positive. That's the positive side of it. It's a double-edged sword. You're quite right. I mean, these days you can go to YouTube and find the same piece played by umpteen number of performers, and it's wonderful to compare all of those, but it's also a surfing type of experience without depth. So it's a sort of nibbling society rather than one that wants a proper meal.
Finally, very briefly, why did you do the book and how did you choose the people that you spoke to?
I wrote the book because of an overwhelming interest in music, and it was a passion. And I wanted to know why I was so interested, why it affected me so much. And I kept on asking friends and musicologists, and I didn't get anywhere. So I thought, if I could do it, perhaps through performance, I would get a different view on it, because I didn't see many books on that subject. And in fact, I found that so many of the performing musicians were really interested. They wanted to tell me. They couldn't wait to tell me what they thought about the philosophy and how music affected them and why they were doing it, because they only communicated through the music itself. And actually the verbal part of it was something that was close to them. They were very intellectual, many of them, and very willing to share with me and wanting to share with me what their views were.
Many thanks, Ada. The last time that, the former time that I had a lecture address this in the Institute, as I recall, was on reforming women in Islam, and tonight on the secret magic of music, and as I said, the book's available over there tonight. I'm not a person with a musical background, but I found that the talk tonight quite fascinating and very informative. So congratulations on another great performance at the Sydney Institute, and best wishes for the success of your latest book. Well done.